to get started a little bit earlier today because John Berlinski has told me that I have to stop precisely at 12:30 or before today. So if I by chance run over 12:30 by mistake, someone just stop me. You know, feel free to just put the, you know, it's like in vaudeville they had this cane where they, you know, would grab someone by the neck and just hold them off stage, and so it should be like that. Okay, so I made a total mess of last lecture, in my opinion, and or at least the last half of last lecture, and so partly today will be about trying to clean up that mess, and then also hopefully at the end we'll have time to say something about baryogenesis. Okay, but first, as I mentioned last time, I'm basically fresh out of Russian jokes, at least that I can remember off the top of my head. But it occurred to me after yesterday's joke, which was stolen from the movie Annie Hall, that there were actually other good jokes in the movie Annie Hall, I was remembering yesterday. So there's another one where there's an old couple goes to the Catskills. The Catskills is like a resort in upstate New York. It's where people would go. I'm not even sure they're still open, but like my grandparents and my great-grandparents would have gone to vacation in the Catskills for a week during the summer. Anyway, so I like to imagine that they are the people in this joke. But an old couple is in a restaurant in the Catskills, and they're complaining about the restaurant. And one says, you know, this restaurant is terrible. You know, the food is terrible. And the other one says, yeah, I agree, in such small portions. That's the whole joke. See, that I think, for example, is a good joke, but you disagree. We just don't see eye to eye about these things, but that's okay. Okay. So, last lecture was supposed to be a one lecture whirlwind tour of dark matter and dark energy, and that was probably a dumb idea in retrospect, but. And then today was supposed to be about a similar whirlwind tour, just to give you a taste of the idea of baryogenesis, or in other words, the theory of how the anti-symmetry between matter and antimatter were created in the universe. But let's go back and first say a few more words, say some more about dark matter and dark energy. So one thing that I tried to get across last time is that, okay, to fit the data, you need to add the minimal model that fits the data appear at the moment, the minimal model that people have found that fits the data, and without altering Einstein's theory of general relativity, involves adding two strange components, energy components, to the universe. So you have to put in about 25% of the universe that is, quote-unquote, dark matter, so 25% of the universe today is dark matter, which all we really know about it is that it behaves as if it were a perfect fluid with pressure over density approximately equal to zero. Other than that, we haven't been able to scatter particles off of it or see any particles scattered from it. We, at the moment, only have gravitational evidence for its existence, even though we're trying to detect it in non-gravitational ways in a number of different experiments, which have so far been unsuccessful. And then dark energy. Today, we seem to have to add it in a very large amount. It needs to be about 70% of the density of the universe today. And it has an equation of state approximately equal to minus one. So its pressure is, its energy density is positive, its pressure is negative and equal to minus its energy density. And I tried to sketch, I mean, we don't have time to go through the sort of full web of evidence for either of these things, but I tried to sketch at least that the nature of the evidence for this guy mostly has to do with gravitational clumping. So tiny fluctuations from one point to another in space of the density field at early times grew via gravitational instability. Slightly denser regions had a little bit more gravity, and so more matter accumulated there, and they became even more and more dense. Slightly less dense regions had a little bit less gravity, so matter flowed out of them, and they became less and less dense. And eventually, that instability led to the overdense regions becoming the really extremely overdense structures that we see in the universe today. You know, rare but overdense structures, galaxies and stars and clusters of galaxies and so forth. And the most of the evidence for dark matter has to do with that in clumped objects, either to help that clumping along, or for example, in the CMB, I explained that to get the CMB oscillations right, you have to have dark matter there to clump and provide the potential wells in which the baryons and photons can oscillate and give rise to an oscillatory spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. And then today, if you look at clumped objects, galaxies, the stars orbiting around in galaxies, or the galaxies rotating around in clusters of galaxies, or gravitational lensing of background galaxies by foreground clusters of galaxies, all of these things, all of these different ways of measuring the total mass in a clump of in a big clumpy object today, suggests that the total amount of mass is much larger than the amount that you can account for just in terms of baryonic matter, the matter that the atoms in the periodic table. Whereas here, the evidence has really nothing to do with. It's not about clumping. The evidence mostly has the form that you either have to explain, you have to invoke this to explain why the sort of unperturbed Friedman, Robertson, Walker background of the universe is spatially flat. In other words, why rho is equal to rho critical today, whereas if you didn't include this extra component, rho would only be equal to, you know, 30% of rho critical today. And relatedly, you have to invoke dark energy to explain various observations that trace how the scale factor evolved with time, how the homogeneous scale factor evolved with time. So today, basically, if there was only this amount of matter in the universe, it would have been slowing down in a certain way. Its acceleration, a double dot, would have been negative throughout the recent past, and instead what you find is that since the universe was roughly 2 times smaller than it is today, it has in fact been, the scale factor in fact appears to have to be accelerating to explain those data. And another point that I just want to get across is all of these different web of tests up here, you know, an important thing to stress is that they all appear to more or less give consistent pictures of how much extra dark matter you need. And similarly, this web of tests, they give a consistent picture of how much extra dark energy you need. And so I think that's maybe all I'm going to say about that. Let me say another word about this number has given rise to the so-called cosmological constant problem or vacuum energy problem in cosmology. And that is that, it has two facets, but let's start by explaining it before explaining those two facets, you know, it's important to remind you that there is this sort of ambiguity between the cosmological constant and the so-called vacuum energy density. So if you look at if you take the theory of Einstein gravity, including a cosmological constant, so that the action has the Ricci scalar and then minus 2 lambda. So this is the so-called Einstein-Hilbert part of the action, and then the cosmological constant contribution to the action is like that. And then we add whatever, all the additional terms are the so-called matter Lagrangian. So let's take, for the simplest example again, simplest model case for concreteness, is a single scalar field. by you can see there's really two terms here. The constant part. So if we write v of phi as let's say v of phi has some function looks like this. It has a minimum here. Then we can split v of phi into a constant offset plus another function whose minimum is at zero, right? Really there's no distinction. There's at this level, there's no distinction between the constant lambda and this constant. You can see that we've really redundantly written the action here. In other words, if I shifted, I could always reinterpret the cosmological constant as zero. It's just a constant in this inside the brackets here, and that v constant term is also just a constant inside the brackets. I can always just reinterpret a non-zero value of lambda as lambda equals zero by absorbing that non-zero value of lambda into a shift of this constant term. Or alternatively, I can always interpret a non-zero value of this constant as actually this constant being zero by just reabsorbing it into lambda. So there's really no clear distinction between the question of whether the cosmological constant is non-zero and the question of what the overall constant offset of the vacuum energy of the theory is. But the problem is that problem number one is that when you think of it in these terms, quantum field theorists, if you give them a theory, they and some energy up to which that theory is supposed to be valid, they can use effective field theory to estimate what should be the typical values, the typical coefficients of every term in the potential, including the constant term in the potential. And the problem is that the typical, the expected value of the constant term, the natural expected order of magnitude for the constant term in the potential, is the cutoff energy to the fourth power. And so, for example, for the standard model where we think the cutoff energy is at least one TeV, at least 1,000 GeV, this is 10 to the 12 GeV to the fourth. Whereas, by contrast, the measured energy density, if you rewrite this in terms of GeV to the fourth, well, it's many orders of magnitude smaller than this. The energy density is more like 10 to the minus 3 EV to the fourth. Okay, where GeV is a billion EV. So the measured value is many, many, many orders of magnitude smaller than the sort of theoretical expectation for what this constant, for what the vacuum energy should be. So that's one puzzle that has no satisfactory explanation at the moment. And then a second part of the cosmological constant problem is just that is sometimes called the why now puzzle. So in a way, this problem is just a quantum field theory problem. It maybe has nothing to do with the evolution of the universe. It's a constant in the action that is extremely small relative to what people would expect on the basis of effective field theory. But then, in addition, we keep drawing this picture of the various energy densities, the various energy components in the universe. We have radiation, which scales to a to the minus 4. And then, when the universe was a few thousand times smaller than it is today, when the scale factor was a few thousand times smaller, matter density overtook the radiation density and dominated for a while. And then today, suddenly dark energy is crossing over and coming to dominate. And the question is, it just seems like an uncomfortable coincidence that the moment that we happen to be observing the universe happens to be at a randomly chosen epoch in cosmic history, especially if you compare these two guys, which are scaling very differently with the scale factor. This one is scaling as a to the minus 3. This one is scaling as a to the 0. At a randomly chosen epoch, one of these will dominate or the other one will dominate. It just seems a bit weird that we happen to live, that we're lucky enough to live right at the epoch where they're crossing. If we had lived 1,000 e-folds in the future, this guy would have been a billion times larger than this guy, and we might have never figured out that this component was there at all. If we lived even a factor of 10 in the 10 in the future, this would be 1,000 times smaller. It would be very difficult to detect. If we lived a factor of 10 in the past, we never would have realized that there was dark energy present. So what's going on with that? There are those two puzzles. As far as I'm aware, neither of those have satisfactory answers at the moment. I mean, maybe it is the answer that it just is a coincidence, and coincidences happen. It's possible. And then also, maybe here, again, effective field theory doesn't predict the precise value. It predicts the expected order of magnitude, but maybe by some coincidence, when integrating out higher scales in the theory to get the low energy effective theory, somehow some magical cancellation happens and we're just lucky and it cancels down to some very small value. But the fact that there are these two uncomfortable coincidences that both seem to relate to the same constant suggests that probably there is some better explanation that people just haven't found yet. I think I won't even dwell on possible models for that because I just think there's no good one. There's no one that's really worth learning at the moment. Dark matter. Dark matter. There we at least have more plausible candidates for what it could be. Things that various possible extensions of the standard model of particle physics that would make this seem less puzzling. And I was saying those broke historically. Those have broken into two varieties. There are machos. This is basically the idea, roughly speaking, that dark matter is a lot of macroscopic black holes floating around. It turns out if you have a lot of macroscopic black holes, those are quite hard to detect in general. Usually the way we've detected black holes up to now is that we see the black holes that happen to be surrounded by a disk of gas that's falling onto them, and that gas emits a lot of light, and that's how we can see that they're there and then infer that they are probably a black hole. Or they're the supermassive black holes at the centers of galaxies, but those are another matter. I don't have time to explain this, but I will just draw your attention to the fact that there was this great paper in 1986 by this astrophysicist named Bodin Pashinsky, where he pointed out that if the dark matter halo of the Milky Way was really made up of a lot of black holes or compact objects, that in fact you would, there was a way to detect them. And via that scheme, he managed to rule out a great swath of the possible masses for these things. The idea there is called gravitational microlensing. So gravitational microlensing here the idea is that you have gravitational microlensing is the case where you have a background source star and then a mass moves in front of the star. So one of our little black holes in the Milky Way halo, we're standing over here looking at the star, and one of the many little black holes in the halo floats near our line of sight to the star. So it's the black hole is small enough that although in principle it gravitationally lenses this source and so moves it around on the sky like a lens would, like a lens passing in front of the source would. the deflection, the actual deflection angle of the source on the sky is too small to detect. Nevertheless, what you can detect, he points out, is that it leads to a little magnification in the amount of light from this star. So this star is emitting photons in all direction. Normally, you only receive your fair share of those photons in your telescope. But as the black hole passes by, a little bit more of those photons get bent towards your telescope. You get a little bit more than your fair share. And so as the black hole floats by, what you see is if you're monitoring the star, there's a little period where its intensity goes up and then down again. And this period can vary from less than a minute to years, to as long as you can, as long as you have patience to stare at it with a telescope. But anyway, via this method, via monitoring stars and counting how many times you see them, exhibit a blip that could be a candidate for such microlensing. People have been able to basically rule out that the machos consist of black holes in the mass range between about 100 times the mass of our sun to about almost a billionth the mass of our sun. So they've been able to rule out 10 orders of magnitude. You might say that the astrophysically most interesting or most plausible 10 orders of magnitude in mass range. So there's maybe a little window. It's always conceivable. It's kind of hard to arrange and not very. There's no appealing models for doing this, but in principle, you could still have the machos be black holes that are even bigger than this or even smaller than this. Although then if they get too small again, you run into trouble. If they get smaller than about 10 to the 15 grams, so that's about the mass of Mount Everest. If they get smaller than that, smaller black holes evaporate faster. If they get smaller than that, these guys evaporate in less than the age of the universe, which is about the inverse of today's Hubble expansion rate. So they evaporate in less than about 10 billion years. That's a lot smaller than this, and so there's a gap on the low mass end that could conceivably be where dark matter is. There's a gap up here, but there's no very appealing way that people have proposed to get that to happen. So although it's a theoretical possibility, it's not a very popular one. So the other alternative, besides machos, are WIMPs, basically the idea that the dark matter is a fundamental particle. Like, we know there are some fundamental particles, even in the standard model, that are just hard to detect. Neutrinos are very hard to detect. Neutrons, for that matter, if they were stable particles, would be quite hard to detect on their own. So it turns out you can't do it with just the weakly interacting particles and the hard to detect particles in the standard model. Neutrons don't work because they're not stable. Neutrinos don't work for reasons that I explained a little bit about last time. But nevertheless, people are looking at the LHC. There's various reasons to think that the standard model is not the whole story. That there will be some a next step in the train of models of elementary particle physics, and you can hope that there will be new particle candidates in those models. That will be viable dark matter candidates. And, more generally, the theme of yesterday and today's lecture is supposed to be kind of, two things in parallel. On the one hand, it's supposed to be introducing you to the idea of dark matter and dark matter and baryogenesis. But on the other hand, it's supposed to be a taste of just a kind of a flash introduction to the notion that the early universe was as good a particle accelerator, particle collider, high energy particle physics experiment as you will ever create on the Earth. So if you have a suggested new model for physics beyond the standard model, an extension of the standard model, it behooves you to not only think about what that model predicts at a high energy collider that reaches energies like the LHC that reaches energies of 1 TeV, but also what it predicts happened in the early universe, which also reached, first of all, densities and temperatures that will never reach on the Earth, and also very well may have reached collision energies that are above what will ever reach on the Earth. And so, you know, if you have any model of particle physics, you should do this. You should say, oh, let me imagine that I put that model into the early radiation-dominated epoch, and the universe expands, the temperature gradually goes down. As that happens, various particles fall out of equilibrium, and then if they're stable, they hang around until today with some relic abundance. Or if they're unstable, they decay into other particles and can do various interesting things like baryogenesis, we'll see. It's a good idea to have the basic tools to think through a model like this. Most models will be ruled out by considerations like this. It turns out there are very tight constraints that come from the early universe. On the other hand, ideally, what you'll find is that there is one particle that freezes out, can't decay, but happens to end up with a relic abundance today that matches the required amount for dark matter, for example. You know, that would be a real clue that you have the right extension of the standard model, or that you're on the right track. Or you have a particle that freezes out, and then when it decays, produces an asymmetry of matter and antimatter that matches the observed asymmetry today. You know, so it goes both ways.
Why didn't these dark matters gather together and build a star or something like that?
Yeah. So it turns out that. So dark matter does clump together and form clumps, but not until it can't do that efficiently until after the matter-dominated era starts, which is relatively late, and then it turns out it can clump, but it can't. At least, it appears both observationally and for typical models that interact as weakly as we think dark matter does, both with us, both with standard model particles and with one another. It turns out that they clump to a point, but then they have a hard time cooling and clumping more. So, for example, when a star forms out of standard model particles. Gravitational instability takes it part of the way, but then as it collapses, it gets hotter and hotter as thermal energy is released by the gravitational collapse, and eventually it would form a big puffy object that didn't collapse to the star that you know and love, because its temperature and pressure would get so high that they would stabilize it at some larger value. So it's key there that it can radiate away photons that carry away most of that heat and allow the gravitational collapse to go on and on efficiently to get it down to a compact thing. And so dark matter, again, observationally and in most theoretical models, doesn't seem to be that way. It appears, you know, that's maybe roughly one of the observational requirements is that you shouldn't have your, that's going too far. This is probably mostly more in my mind than it is in a. We see around galaxies and clusters puffy halos that appear to have not cooled efficiently. They're puffed up to sizes larger than the clusters than the galaxies that reside within them. Mm-hmm. So you see that by gravitational lensing, for example, or by these rotation curve measurements that I was describing stars. So it seems that one way or another, you want to make sure that dark matter does not clump. That you want to avoid the possibility that the whole halo can efficiently clump into a very compact thing, because that's not what we observe. But whether, on the other hand, it could be possible that big halo is made up of a lot of tiny clumps of dark matter. Macroscopic dark matter clumps, in the same way that our galaxy is made up of largely of clumps of stars, which now that they're clumped into stars, that whole gas of stars can't cool efficiently either, and it hangs around for a long time.
Well, I didn't get the point. So what's the reason that they couldn't clump?
The first or second point, the reason that they can't clump in the early universe before matter domination, or the reason that they can't, that's something that I want to explain
in
a subsequent
lecture.
In
the era that stars are building up, and we have stars and things like that, why don't we have dark matter?
So it appears to be the case that if dark matter is made of massive particles, mm-hmm. that unlike in the standard model, where those massive particles like protons can efficiently radiate massless particles that can fly away and just leave the gravitational potential well, carry away energy but leave the gravitational potential well, it appears that dark matter particles can't do that.
So what are they going to do?
They hang around in big puffy halos. The statement is that if dark matter is just massive particles that essentially don't interact with anything, they don't bump into each other, they don't radiate anything like a photon, they're just massive particles that just collapse under their own gravitational instability, then the numerical simulations show that they collapse into halos that rather resemble the ones that we seem to see observationally around galaxies and clusters. Mm-hmm. So they don't really need to do anything more than what they already are doing.
So in principle, if you were having some way of, some interaction between dark matter, it couldn't couple to, for example, to photons.
Well, you don't want it to couple. You certainly want the coupling to photons to be very weak, because mm-hmm. we can detect photons very, very well, and so.
No, but if it wasn't
dark photons, you mean like dark analogs of photons or something?
No,
photons.
So I mean having some coupling between dark photons and photons, for example.
Between dark photons and photons, yeah. You also in general you want to stay a mile away because there's very tight constraints. It's very hard to get. So there's one thing that people do hope to see, which is annihilation of two dark matter particles, that ultimately produces as part of its cascade photons in the standard model. So that is constrained to some degree, but it's hoped that it's just below the observational constraints. And you'll see it when you search harder, when you look harder at the centers of galaxies or the centers of dwarf galaxies, where you might hope that signal would be the most pronounced. But in general, yes, for single dark matter particles, there's very tight constraints on how much on how strongly they can couple two photons, even not directly, even just indirectly, via a dark photon.
No, but even if they couple very weakly, and they could still, in principle, form black holes and form compact objects.
Yeah. Oh, you mean that's right. That's right. There's two sorts of constraints. There's a constraint that it can't couple to photons because you haven't seen those photons. But then there's another sort of constraint, exactly, that if it could cool too efficiently by coupling to light degrees of freedom, by radiating light degrees of freedom, then you would see, or you might see, the halos clumped more than they are. But I was saying there is kind of a caveat to that. That's not so clear because, again, take the example of what happens in galaxies. Stars themselves, their clumping is greatly aided by radiating photons. But then once most of the matter in a galaxy is clumped into stars, if you just take a gas of stars, a galaxy that is most of whose mass is stars and they're just orbiting around one another, then the particles in that are just these big massive particles. Each particle is a star, and those do not that whole gas of giant super, very, very massive macroscopic particles does not cool efficiently. The galaxy will hang around for a very long time, very, very much like a dark matter halo does, without all collapsing to its center. So it could be that dark matter is like that. It could be that somehow on small starish scales, the dark matter has clumped up and we just haven't detected those clumps, and that now the big halos are not cooling anymore because all the dark matter has collapsed into clumps already. That's why I began to say what you were saying, and then I backtracked for that reason. So it's not so clear. Yeah.
So why is it not possible that the dark matter particles actually couple the photons quite strongly, but their density is very small.
The density of dark matter particles?
Yeah.
Well, so their number density is very small?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question, yeah. So you know, we know what their total energy density is, but it's true that if each dark matter particle gets very, very, very massive, then that number density can be accounted for by quite a small number, quite a rare number of dark matter particles. And it's probably true that the coupling, that the bound on the coupling strength to photons depends on the mass of the dark matter particle for that reason, that fewer and fewer dark matter particles will get what you say. So it certainly will depend. So you'll have a different, you'll probably get a weaker and weaker bound. From the process you're thinking, of is kind of called bremsstrahlung, just radiating a photon, a single guy radiating a photon. I mean, another problem is that as you make a particle more and more massive, more decay channels become kinematically allowed for it. There are more possible ways for it to decay. So anyway, a lot of these things come down to particular models if you want to really make a precise statement. But anyway, I certainly agree with the basic thought. Yeah.
Is there a reason why we assume that it's discrete, like particles or black holes? Why it can't be like a continuous fluid?
People have kind of written models like that. The main thing is that it appears that the lesson of history is that physics is described by fields that are quantized, and then the quanta of those fields are particles. So, even a fluid like water is ultimately made of it's just a very dense and sort of strongly correlated fluid of particles. But it could be that dark matter is like that it's more fluidy and less gassy than we imagine. That's not true because if you want to make so many dark matter particles that they're in some sense close to one another, yeah, you have to make them too, you know what the energy density is, so you have to make their masses very small, and before you get to that point they become so low in mass that they're too relativistic today and they would have streamed too far, wiped out too much structure. It's the same thing I was saying about a hot relic yesterday, that you can't have dark matter particles be too light.
Rather just completely continuous, no particles at all.
Yeah.
But that's...
If they were thermally produced... See, the thing is, each of these arguments is actually rather... Most everything I'm saying, I'm right after I say it, I realize that there's an argument around it. But the fact of the matter is that there are really tons of possibilities that are allowed, and you can escape from almost every statement about dark matter by fiddling with the nature of the model of the dark matter. The main things that one appears to know are its density today, the fact that it appears to be cold, so the individual particles appear to have not been able to stream too far across the universe, and that it's dark, that whatever it is, its cross section for interaction with standard model particles is sufficiently low. Okay. When we think about, if we assume that dark matter is elementary particles, they cannot still be in thermal equilibrium today. So we said you can sort of think systematically about it by saying they either were in thermal equilibrium at early times, in which case they're a so-called thermal relic. Or they never were in thermal equilibrium. So, and last time, I'm not going to go through the calculation again, but last time, unfortunately I kind of rushed through the calculation last time, and I'm hoping that you had a chance to be a little bit more clear about how the calculation went when you went through it in tutorial. But if anyone is still confused about those calculations from last time, you know, please do come up, and I'm happy to go through them again, but more slowly. But so the hot thermal relic, you know, we saw you really get very qualitatively different answers about how much density you get today for a given dark matter particle, depending on whether it froze out when it was still relativistic, in which case it's called a hot thermal relic, or when it was non-relativistic. The takeaway point was that there is this expression for a hot thermal relic that says that its density today divided by the critical density today, so the relic density divided by the critical density today, the formula is proportional to its mass divided by an EV, okay, with not very big proportionality constants. So it says that unless this relic has a mass of less than roughly 10 EV, which is really very light by particle physics standards, it will overclose the universe. It will be in conflict with the observed amount of relic matter today. And it can't be the dark matter for reasons that I've decided to come back and try to explain this point after, on Friday, I've had a chance to say a little bit more about how perturbations work. But a particle this light would be relativistic until too late in the universe's history. So it would just manage to geodesically stream across too long a distance. And as it did so, as the particles streamed across those distances, whatever distance they managed to stream across before they become non-relativistic, all density perturbations on those scales essentially get wiped out, and too much structure would be wiped out thereby if the particle was this low in mass. So we learned that the dark matter cannot be a particle that was initially in thermal equilibrium and decoupled when it was still relativistic. It can be a particle that was in thermal equilibrium and decoupled when it was already non-relativistic. And in fact, we got this interesting formula that if you imagine that it is a particle that decoupled when it was non-relativistic, it was initially thermally equilibrated and then fell out of equilibrium when it was non-relativistic, we derived this formula, which is, you know, this is not an example of something that I think you should remember for the rest of your life. Not the particular formula, but the basic idea is that times some stuff that can't be too much different from unity. It might be, you know, you might get an order of magnitude here or there, but so this formula is telling you that you can do it with a cold thermal relic. You could, that's what dark matter could be. That, and if it is, an exercise like this has told you something very important about the fundamental particle physics of that particle. That its annihilation cross section. Has to be roughly 10 to the minus 10 inverse GeV squared. And we said, so not only did we learn that useful fact, but it's kind of suggestive that maybe this is on the right track, because this is quite a natural weak interaction cross section from a particle physics standpoint. We said this is roughly the cross section that you would get if both chi particles were roughly the mass of the proton and they interacted through a weak boson, like the, you know, with a mass of, let's say, the ordinary weak boson mass, the Z or W mass, to some you know, whatever, to the standard model particles. So that's kind of our one positive hint, I would say, about what dark matter actually is, as opposed to all of the other hints, which are statements about what it's not. And then I wanted to finally briefly explain the idea of a non-thermal relic. The classic example here is a particle called the axion, and this is a calculation is similar to what you did in the tutorial on Monday. So again, I'm maybe not going to go through all the algebra on the board, but again, I just want to get across the key idea. So up here, somehow a key trick that was used in both of these calculations and that is useful again and again when you're talking about something that went out of thermal equilibrium and now you're trying, something happens, some particle went out of thermal equilibrium and maybe it subsequently decayed and you want to know what is its abundance today or what is the abundance of some conserved quantity related to that particle today. You know, you again and again, the basic argument is to say, okay, right after freeze out, what is the number density of that particle or whatever conserved quantity that particle decays to or produces in its decay? Right at the moment of freeze out, what's the ratio of that to the entropy density of the universe at freeze out? And then under the assumption that particle is stable, for example, or that whatever conserved quantity it produces in its decay is conserved over subsequent history, and that subsequent history is quasi-adiabatic, that there's no subsequent big generation of entropy, then you can estimate its number density today. Then this ratio should be conserved. And so you can estimate the number density of that particle or whatever conserved quantity it led to today by a formula like this, where usually you can write down expressions for these three guys, and thereby infer this quantity, the quantity that you're ultimately after. So again, that basic line of argument, you know, you use that sort of line of argument again and again when you're evaluating the particle physics or the cosmology of a particle physics model. So the non-thermal relics are good to talk about also because they introduce us to the other sort of trick that comes up again and again. It just comes up everywhere in cosmology. And that is just that, again and again, because the universe is expanding, you know, physics is replete with second-order differential, linear differential equations. And then because the universe is expanding, there's an extra friction term in that differential equation because of the expansion of the universe. And so that, and again and again, what happens is that as the universe evolves, that equation of motion looks like the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator that makes a transition at some point in the evolution of the universe from overdamped to underdamped. So let me just say, so this is important enough that I want to go back to discuss it in some detail. So I remind you from undergraduate physics, according to Newton, F equals ma. And then this is mx double dot. And then let's say that the force that is acting on this particle is, okay, there's a spring with spring constant k. There's some force that's linear in the, restoring force that's linear in this displacement. And then some frictional force minus b times v, or in other words, minus b times x dot. Okay, so I'll just divide by m on both sides and rewrite this a little bit. We get a differential equation, which you will know and love. Just taking this equation, dividing by m, renaming some of the coefficients. You know, we have the equation of motion for a harmonic oscillator that oscillates with frequency omega, and subject to a frictional force quantified by this damping constant gamma. So gamma here is just e divided by m, and omega squared is just k divided by m. Okay, and you'll remember that, so the solution of this equation, well, it's a second-order linear differential equation. There's two independent solutions, and we get them here by guessing the form x is proportional to e to the gamma t. plug that into this expression, and we get, you know, gamma squared plus 2 little gamma capital gamma plus omega squared all times e to the gamma t is equal to 0. So in other words, the thing in square brackets is equal to 0. Solve the quadratic equation for gamma. It has two solutions. Okay, so it has two solutions, and the remember that so the nature of those two solutions qualitatively changes depending on whether omega is greater or less than gamma, right? Because then either we have two complex solutions or two real solutions here. So the case where omega is equal to gamma, and the two solutions degenerate, that's the two exponents degenerate. That's the so-called critically damped case. If omega is greater than gamma, that's the case where this is imaginary and we have oscillatory solutions, so a harmonic oscillator that oscillates and then the friction gradually damps out those oscillations. And then if omega is less than gamma, that's the so-called overdamped case. Both of the solutions are real, and instead of oscillating, the harmonic oscillator just oozes down to 0. Okay, so now let's consider. Let's go over to the cosmological case that for the non-thermal relic. So imagine we just take the standard model Lagrangian and add an extra term to it. We just add. An extra term corresponding to an extra scalar field that's coupled to nothing. It's just a single, simplest thing we can add, single, real, massive scalar field. So we just take the rest of the Lagrangian of the universe and just add this guy. Okay, so the equation of motion for this guy in an expanding universe, you derive, you can just derive it here by varying phi within the action, and you derived it via the continuity equation in Monday's lecture. And anyway, to make a long story short, it has an equation of motion like this. And you know, so this looks a lot like this guy, except. So where m squared over there is omega squared over here, the difference is that here, gamma, the friction is a constant, independent of time, whereas here, the friction coefficient is the Hubble constant, the Hubble expansion rate, which is changing with time. And in general, as the universe expands, the Hubble constant is decreasing with time. And so the typical behavior here will not be that the field either is overdamped or underdamped for all time. It's that at early times, when h is bigger than m, it will act as if like an overdamped oscillator. And then at some point, there will be some special moment in the universe's history when h drops to become equal to m, and then after that, subsequent to that, h will be much less than m, and suddenly it'll behave like an underdamped oscillator. Okay, so in pictures, here's the potential, here's the field's potential, 1/2 m squared phi squared. And so if it's displaced for some reason in the early universe, it basically just sits there, it just slowly oozes down. Doesn't manage to make much progress, and then after this transition point, suddenly it's free to oscillate, and it oscillates like an underdamped harmonic oscillator does. The frequency of an underdamped harmonic oscillator So in other words, in the region where gamma has now become much smaller than omega, the oscillatory frequency is roughly omega, but then there's still this, gamma is not zero, it still has an effect, it still causes this damping. And so that's what happens here. After the transition moment, this guy oscillates with frequency m, but the oscillations get smaller and smaller as the universe evolves. And another thing that you worked out in the tutorial on Monday is how fast those oscillations damp away. Uh-oh, I gotta stop. This time I'm really supposed, John is gonna, he's gonna, you know, that guy. He's, I don't know if you fear him as much as I do, but he's a, no, but he did ask me to stop. So I think I will stop now, and so we're almost done with dark matter, and then, in fact, luckily, baryogenesis is a lot shorter than dark matter, so I think it'll only take half of next lecture, but I have a history of not being very good at estimating these things, so it's possible it'll eat up all of next lecture. Anyway, we'll get there.